Randy Mosher, the author of Mastering Homebrew and Tasting Beer, joins me this week to talk about sensory evaluation. This is Beersmith Podcast number 146.
This is the Beersmith Home Brewing Show, where brewing great beer is our passion. If you want to take your brewing to the next level, visit beersmith.com, where you can download a trial version of our Beersmith software, subscribe to the newsletter, and get dozens of free articles on home brewing. And now, your host and the author of Home Brewing with Beersmith, Brad Smith.
This is Beersmith Podcast number 146, and it's early April 2017. Randy Mosher, the author of Radical Brewing and many other books, joins me to talk about tasting beer. Thank you to this week's sponsors, Craft Beer and Brewing Magazine. They're running an amazing deal right now, only $19.99 a year for a year-long subscription, or $17.99 for the digital edition. Every issue of Craft Beer and Brewing Magazine is packed with articles for homebrewers and beer lovers. And you can read my new column called Ask the Experts there. Take advantage of their special deal at beerandbrewing.com. Again, that's beerandbrewing.com. And also the new BrewVision thermometer from Blickman Engineering. This interactive wireless digital thermometer connects right to your iPhone or iPad and lets you remotely monitor and record temperatures. You can also download your recipes right from the Beersmith Cloud and send updates and alerts as you brew. Get the BrewVision Bluetooth thermometer today. Another great innovation from BlickmanEngineering.com. Again, that's BlickmanEngineering.com. And finally, Beersmith Mobile. The mobile version of Beersmith is a perfect complement to our desktop brewing software. It includes all the tools you need to create recipes on the go, share them with friends, and act as a pocket brew timer. Check out Beersmith Mobile at beersmith.com/mobile or on the Google Play, iTunes, or Amazon app stores. And now let's jump into this week's episode. Today, I welcome back the one and only Randy Mosher. Randy is author of the books Mastering Homebrew, Radical Brewing, and the just updated second edition of Tasting Beer. Randy is a graphic artist, partner at Five Rabbit Brewery, and has a website at randymosher.com. Randy, it is fantastic to have you on the show again.
Thank you, Brad. Great to be here. I would be remiss if we didn't mention my other brewery partnership. They'll get mad if they're not listed too. It's a brewery here in Chicago called Forbidden Root.
Forbidden Root. Is that a new one? Yeah. I remember Five Rabbit, but...
Well, we started about 3 years ago. We got a brew pub open just a little bit over a year ago. We're doing botanically influenced beers. So really trying to work with all of the different flavors and ingredients that are out there.
That sounds awesome.
Yeah. We just did a collaboration with Fernet Branca.
On what? What'd you actually do?
Well, we made a Fernet Branca beer.
I don't know what a Fernet Branca is. I'm sorry.
So Fernet is one of those bitter Italian liqueurs that's got like 30 different ancient herbs and spices in it. And it's very hot among the sort of cool bar kid.
Oh, that's the problem. I'm not a cool bar kid.
Well, I'm not either. So. Yeah. But we put it together. It was pretty fun.
Well, let's see. We had you on last on discussing historical beer myths, and that was way back in episode number 115. What have you been up to the last year and a half or so?
Well, really, just working on with these two breweries has been the big thing, and trying to get them really cooking, and takes a lot of time with between the work I do with the creative development with some of the beers and the graphics and the branding and all of that. So that's most of my time right there.
Yeah, I imagine you probably do all the labels and branding and marketing probably, right?
Well, not all the marketing, a lot of it. I do the branding and the packaging. Yeah, so that's my big contribution. But awesome. We're always changing something, always something new. You can't stand still in the beer biz, you know?
No, you can't. No. Well, you just released a new edition of the book, Tasting Beer, and I actually have a copy in my hot little hands here. Yeah. What are some of the things that you changed in the new edition?
Well, I just thought it was about time to update it and make sure that it really kept up with the fast paced changing world of the beer scene. So rejiggered some of the styles, added a few more styles. Lucky enough to get the New England IPA thing in. So that's pretty brand new as far as books goes, and really tried to give people better tools for working with flavor to understand their brains better, understand how their mind works, how their sensory system works. There's been a huge amount of research in that in the last few years, and of course I've learned a lot also, so I thought that was important to do. I did rewrite the beer and food chapter altogether. Been doing quite a bit of work with that. I'm on a committee with some of the people from the BA and Cicerone and some other people, and we're trying to try and figure out a little bit of scientific basis behind beer and food. So try to incorporate some of that. I also ran it by Ray and Pat at the Cicerone organization because they recommend that book, as so many people use it as a study guide. So I gave them the opportunity to give it the once over, which was good because Pat found a few little errors and questioned a few assumptions that I had made, which is great. And also I added a little bit of content on draft systems and a couple other things just to make it line up with their syllabus really well. So that's about it. Yeah.
I was wondering if you could just talk for a minute about the Cicerone program. A lot of people may not be familiar with it. You know, I did an episode with Ray Daniels, but that was a couple of years back now.
Yeah, well, the Cicerone program was started by Ray. Of course, he and I were good friends. We almost started a brewery together back in the late mid-1990s, but he was looking for something else to do, and he's a really good business guy, really good organizer, and a real great thinker about beer. So he put together a program that is the beer world's equivalent of a sommelier. At the moment, they've got four different levels of certifications you can get, from a online exam that's sort of typically taken by people who are maybe working as bartenders and things like that, up through a certified Cicerone, and then a master, which is the top level, and he's got one more advanced, I think he calls it. And so that master exam, I think about one in 20 people pass who take it. Maybe one in 15, something like that. So it's pretty rigorous. I think there's not even a dozen masters right now. So it's a 2-day in-person exam with a lot of tastings. I help do some of the beer and food stuff for him. So it's pretty fun to do.
And go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, sorry. Go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say, you mentioned that they've been using your book as a study guide. So let's start with one of the more important topics, which is sensory evaluation. I was wondering if you could talk about that.
Big topic. Well, you really can't talk about sensory evaluation without talking about your sensory system. And I think it's really important for people to kind of understand how we're put together. So, we've got aroma, we've got taste, and, surprisingly, it's sometimes a little bit difficult to actually tease those two things apart. Tastes are things that happen on the tongue and elsewhere in your mouth. Sweet, sour, salty, bitter. Now there's a bunch of new ones. We could talk about that later. But people often say something smells sweet, for example, or your brain is trying to be helpful to you, so it creates something called flavor that it combines taste, mouthfeel, aroma, and sort of puts it all together. So as tasters, you have to kind of train yourself to really separate those things out. So aroma, you not only get by smelling through your nose like you would expect to, but there's also a really important form of smelling called retronasal olfaction. And that's what happens once that liquid's in your mouth and you swallow it. If you close your mouth and exhale through your nose, you actually get a little bit more of a aroma impression, but it's perceived differently by your brain, and your brain wants to kind of roll it in with everything else that it's learned from the taste and mouthfeel to create flavor. The other thing about a retronasal and what's important about tasting is that there are these chemicals called glycosides that are sugar molecules to which other more active molecules like aroma molecules have been bound up, and because they're bound to sugar, these aroma molecules just sit there. So in the brewing process, the process itself creates glycosides, for example, of hop aromas. And those hop aromas stay all the way through fermentation. They stay through packaging. And when you put that beer in your mouth, the enzymes in your saliva, along with enzymes from the whole bunch of bacteria that are living in your mouth, actually can liberate some of those glycosides and give you another hit of aroma. So that's why that tasting process is, or that retronasal taste is really important, because you may be tasting things that are in your beer in your mouth that weren't there in the glass. So that's a pretty cool thing to know about. So, you know, the basic thing is smell first, because there are aromas in beer that are very volatile, and you smell them right away, and they may be gone in 5 minutes. So you always want to get yourself into the glass. Sometimes it's good to actually sort of just wave your glass in front of your nose and see if you can pick something up from there, because there are certain things like skunkiness and certain sulfur compounds that are really lightweight and volatile that are easier smelled from a distance, if that makes any sense. Mm-hmm. If you get your nose in the glass and really give it a sniff, you may overwhelm your sensors and load them up and miss them. So do that kind of drive-by tasting, they call it. And then think about the taste not as a single snapshot in time, but as a little movie, you know, that it has a time dimension. At the beginning, you're going to get a lot of, any of the sweetness or acidity that's there will hit you right away, any minerality, because those things register pretty quickly. But then over time, that bitterness will build, may take 5 seconds, 10 seconds. In a really bitter beer, it may take 30 seconds to fully develop. If you've got one of those massive double IPAs with 100 BUs, you won't even notice that extra bitterness until 20, 30 seconds in. It's kind of amazing. And watch that. If you ever taste a beer you know to be super bitter, just watch that bitterness build and build and build and build. And then, of course, the liquid leaves your mouth. Want to pay attention to the quality, the characteristic of the experience. If there's any harshness, astringency, oxidized, cardboardy, woody sort of flavors in there, those are going to come up kind of towards the end. So, and that's also a really important aspect of a taste, because if you don't, if it's not clean on the finish, then you kind of don't really want another taste of it. So as a brewer, always strive for cleanness and to reduce any kind of astringency or harshness. Water chemistry is your friend in that regard. So talk to John and get the lesson on that.
And of course, like wine sommeliers, we've developed an entire vocabulary to describe our beer flavors. Can you give us some examples of that? A lot of people may not be familiar.
Well, the object with vocabulary is always to go from the most general to the most specific. So, you know, if you don't know anything about it, you pick up the glass and you say, smells like beer. It's like, great first step. Can you break it down a little bit? And then you maybe think, well, maybe it smells a little bit like malt. Okay, well, that's good. What kind of malt? And, you know, you get people, you got to train yourself to think in detail. So maybe it's a white bread. If it's a Pilsner, for example, you may get like a nice white bread kind of character, or maybe a bit of cracker. If it's a double, you might get cookies and cake and maybe certain types of toffee or caramel. So you always want to be specific. And that's something, again, you have to train yourself to do. With certain vocabulary things, with certain aromas in beer, you can actually know the chemicals. So with fruitiness, for example, you know, it's what kind of fruit. Is a white fruit, red fruit, tropical fruit? But if you come up with bananas, you can push it a little, like you can actually name that, because that's an ester, a chemical named isoamyl acetate. So there's a handful that you can know, maybe 20, 30 chemicals, but that's part of being a professional, is knowing those and having gone through a little bit of training so that you're exposed to those individually.
Yeah, so, I like to look at the off flavors, for example, that are on the BJCP style guide, you know, or BJCP score sheet. Those are a good starting point, yeah, for example.
Those are super helpful, and that, you know, those are all flavors you want to learn. And that's why judging is so important. Even if you have no intention of home brewing or really wanting to judge beer, if you want to be a real expert in beer and the flavor of beer and be a really expert taster, you almost have to judge, because for two reasons. One is that it's a structured environment and you have to sit there and do it for an extended period of time while there's other people watching you. And so you're on your best behavior and you're really, I mean, it focuses the mind like nothing else. But the other thing is that you get a sense over time of where your strengths and weaknesses are. You know, if you're a super taster on musty moldy, you know, you'll be the only person getting it often. But if you're the person at the table who's not getting DMS, you know that's an area that you're just not that sensitive to. So judging is a great opportunity to kind of calibrate your palate a little bit. And of course, you can do flavor training on different individual chemicals, but they present themselves differently in those spiked beer tastings than they do in actual beer, where you typically would have a lot of different things going on at the same time. So it really is a more robust sort of training environment than even good spike sample training.
So what are some of the qualities we look for in a beer? What are some of the things we look for?
Well, it depends on the style, of course. You want the style characteristics to be evident. If you're brewing a pale ale, for example, you'd be looking for some evidence of pale ale malt. That is a type of malt that's a little more heavily kilned than Pilsner malt. So you're going to get a little bit of that cracker, biscuit, just a very, very light sweet toastiness. That's sort of the fundamental, the background for that beer. You'd be looking for hops when appropriate, but not looking for hops when they're not appropriate. So much of the judging is done on styles, and it's very hard to make absolute recommendations. One of the things with judging, you're always going for that style. It's like a strike zone in baseball. It's sort of a boundary within which anything in that's inside of those parameters is acceptable. But often you'll get multiple beers that are in the category, and then your job gets a little more difficult, because your job now is to then figure out which of these beers is better, even though they're all equally within the style. So then you have to start looking for freedom from flaws. That's something that a lot of the competitions actually are kind of flaw-based competitions. So in a way, the judging, you start with a set of beers at the table and you start nitpicking on, oh, this has got a little diacetyl. Oh, this one's got a little bit of DMS and it's not a Pilsner, so it's not appropriate.
Whoever
and
makes the fewest mistakes then.
Well, that's part of it. You know, I mean, I think that's the objective. Certainly, you don't want to give gold medals to beers that have obvious flaws in them. So that's really important. And as a brewer, it's a big challenge, of course, because there's a lot of different ways to brew beer and to brew bad beer. So learning how to make great beer is sort of a part of a process of just training yourself. It's like, okay, I got to deal with water chemistry now. And then you learn about water chemistry and you decide what you're going to do for each different kind of beer, and then you're kind of got that licked. Then, you know, fermentation's obviously a really big one, because you're dealing with living organisms and what they like and what they want, pitch rate, temperature, oxygenation level, many different things influence them, and the health of the yeast that you start with. So that's a big one. So each one of these things takes effort. I think that's probably why a lot of people really enjoy brewing, because it presents challenge after challenge after challenge. And in the end, when you've got flaw-free beers and they're in the category, now what? And I always just sort of switch into consumer mode at the time and think, do I like this beer? Does it have what I call wonderfulness? You know, is it something that I will remember? Is it something I would go out and seek out and buy? And so really, you have to leave all the guidelines behind at a certain point, and you're just there. It's you and the beer, and ultimately, it's a matter of preference. And those are the discussions you have at the judge table, too. And of course, people perceive things differently. People have different ideas. That's part of the judging, is learning how to kind of negotiate and persuade and get everybody on the table to feel good about the decisions that you make as a group.
Yeah, I find every once in a while I find a beer or a wine or a cider or something that just really just sticks in my brain, and that helps drive me. It's like, well, I want some more of that, you know?
I love those. I mean, I think that's what it's really all about. That's where the real art is. When you get those beers that just make you sit back and think, wow, that was really something. And I've got a handful of them in my head that I still come back to and remember. And it's inspiring, really.
Well, I found the section on taste pretty interesting in your new book. I think most of us know about the basic taste responses, you know, sweet, sour, bitter, salty. But what are these things called, you know, umami and kokumi? And I guess there's even more than that now.
There's a bunch of them. There's one for fat. There's one for carbonation, they think. And some of these are a little speculative. Let's see, I heard about another one just the other day. I'm trying to think of what it is. So umami is the first one to really be identified. The Japanese have been talking about it for quite a while because it's an important part of their cuisine. But it is a marker for protein. So it's the taste of amino acids. And specifically, it's three different kinds of amino acid-based chemicals: glutamates, guanylates, and inosinates. And they come from things like seafood, seaweed, cured meat, aged cheese, mushrooms, tomatoes, especially that clear liquid on the inside of tomatoes that we used to throw away, that actually contains a lot of umami. And so umami doesn't have a strong taste of its own. If you ever want to really just taste what umami tastes, get some monosodium glutamate, because again, that's glutamate. That's one of those amino acids. And just put one tiny crystal on your tongue, and you'll get a really rich, round, sort of mouth-filling bouillon cube kind of a sensation. And that's umami. And kokumi is something that you really have a very difficult time tasting on its own, but it does act in your taste system, and it does create a flavor impression, but it primarily acts as an enhancer for other flavors. So in the food industry, where they're trying to figure out how to make things like canned soup not salty, they're using umami type of chemicals and also this kokumi to enhance the flavor of the food, but also importantly to mask the bitterness that is present in canned food, because it's cooked at a high temperature and that cooking process creates a bitterness, and that's why there's so much salt in it. It's not that they really need that much salt or want it to make it taste salty, or even because people like salty things. If they didn't put the salt in, it would actually taste really bitter and foul. And so that's why they're so interested in these things like kokumi. So it's pretty fascinating, and there's just a huge amount of research being done. It appears as though the bitter taste receptors may have been originally created to inform your immune system about invading bacteria, because you have bitter receptors in your nose, you have bitter receptors into all the way through your gut, you have bitter receptors in your bones. So it's, they're doing things in our bodies that we have no awareness of. And it just so happens that the ones on our tongue are actually wired into the circuitry with which we perceive food, but they're there nonetheless elsewhere, and they're doing other things. So it's pretty fascinating. It's this weird little rabbit hole that you go down once you start really looking at the sensory system.
So I assume that is to pick up lactic acid from bacteria as it devours our food, right?
Well, you know, it's not really the acids. It's bacteria apparently have compounds that these bitter receptors will respond to. So that's as much as I understand of it. This is pretty technical microbiology or, you know, biochemistry stuff.
And they're inventing new ones all the time too, right?
They keep finding new ones. Yeah. Like I said, there was another new one. I can't remember what it was. I think it had something to do with protein, but I'm not exactly sure.
And of course, aroma, you mentioned, plays a huge role in how we taste and judge our beer. Can you talk about how aroma feeds into the flavors and really gives us the overall perception?
Well, the perception of aroma is pretty interesting. Also, I mean, all this stuff is crazy interesting. I just love learning about this. So we have about 10,000 receptors in our olfactory bulb on the upper part of our nose. And between 10,000 aromas or 10,000 receptors, we're able to create many more times that in different perceptions. So there are 2,000 beer chemicals in beer, for example. And if you put all the food, you put food together, you think about all the chemicals in food, and you know, anything like cinnamon, for example, has got 200 essential oils, and almost all everything we have has a huge number. So we've got tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of different chemicals that we can smell. And we're also that some recent research, they have determined that we're capable of distinguishing between maybe as much as a trillion or maybe 100 trillion different combinations of aromas that when presented, we're capable of discriminating between. So you can't name them, obviously. We don't have that many words. That's actually part of the problem with tasting things like hops. We have 200 essential oils and other compounds in hops that we can smell, but we don't have words for any of them. We only have words for the things that hops kind of vaguely resemble, like citrus and flowers and pine and things like that. So hop vocabulary is one of the more difficult areas, especially when you compare it to malt vocabulary. You got bread and cracker and cake and cookie and toffee and coffee and chocolate and caramel and nutty, you know, great words. And the words are true because the processes that create all those foods are the same processes that create those flavors in malts. So we have a really great, vocabulary that's very intuitive and easy to understand. But when you get away from the malt, it starts to break down a little bit. So people struggle with it. And the other thing, if you're starting a journey and trying to be a taster, you know, everybody feels like they alone are struggling with vocabulary. And the fact of the matter is that's our brains are not built to make words out of aromas, you know,
the happy flavors, right?
Or flavors. Yeah. Well, flavors even more complex because flavor combines aroma and taste and mouthfeel and what your eyes see and what your brain has already heard. You know, if you know the price of two different beers on the table, that's going to taste different to you. Right. And your brain is going to incorporate that price information in the way that you make judgments and the way that beer is presented to you. If somebody comes and says, hey, this is an extra fruity beer, what do you think? You're going to find fruit in it, whether it's there or not. You know,
Charlie Bamforth on the show one day, and he said they did a blind test where they took the same beer in a triangle test and put different coasters underneath the beer. And depending on the labels of the coasters, it would affect the perception of how people perceive the beer.
You know, I'm trained as a marketing guy, so you know that's good for me because I mean there's a bunch of people out there in the market right now that anything that's not in a can they won't drink or they won't buy. You know, and like, what's so special about a can?
People are quite the opposite too. They won't buy anything that's not in a bottle, right?
Right. And the beer's the same. You know, you can make an argument one way or another that one is a little better at protecting the beer than the other, but they're essentially the same. You know, we're going through this in the breweries. I am. We're going to be starting to can some beers because for these super hoppy New England style beers, we're just the market is telling us that nobody's going to buy them unless they're in 16 ounce cans. And that's just the fact of the matter. So this kind of stuff that seems so tangential and seems really trivial, it actually turns out to be really important for people for whatever reason. You know, we're just curious creatures, and that's just part of the game.
Well, let's switch topics for a minute. Give us a primer on actually judging and tasting a new beer. How would you approach a fresh glass of beer?
Well, fresh glass of beer, make sure you got the right kind of glass, that you've not over poured the beer. That's the best place to start. So about a wine glass, about half full, is a pretty good place to start. Any beer glass that looks a little like a wine glass is probably really good. Get it on the table. Make sure it's at the right temperature. Or a good temperature. You don't want it too cold, or you'll have a problem getting the aroma. And if it does come out too cold, and this is a common issue with judging, because they put beers in the refrigerator and then, you know, they come out to the table. But get it in a glass and get your hand around it and really get some skin contact and kind of gently swirl it, and you will be amazed at how much you can raise that temperature up in a short period of time. So that's definitely something to do. Like I said, do the drive-by smell. So leave it on the table or bring it just by your nose briefly. See if you can get any kind of impression of flavor. If it's helpful to write notes, just because it forces you to focus a little bit more, I think. And so always smell first. Again, think about little sniffs, not great deep inhalations. If you have any of those little flashbacks of memory that occurred, like maybe it all of a sudden puts you in a candy store or a grocery store or someplace, linger in those. If some completely stupid word pops into your head, blurt it out. And I've seen this a lot with my wife, you know, who just like, cause she doesn't care. Right. And just like she tastes a beer and just some word will come out. And it's like, okay, let's figure out what that is, you know, and every time it's meaningful. So that's your brain is like helping you. And so never filter yourself. That's really important. Just let those, whatever the first impression is, just get it out. That's a really important technique to learn and to develop. And then get it in your mouth. Like I said, let it warm up in there a little bit. Don't be in too big of a hurry to swallow it. Pay attention to the flavors as they build, as one diminishes and the other one builds. And then swallow it slowly. Close your lips and exhale slowly through your nose and see if you can pick up another impression of aroma, because it may be similar to what you got through your nose. It may be a little bit different. Certainly your brain processes this a little bit more as flavor, and also presents it to you in the form maybe a little bit more about familiarity or novelty or preference or dislike. So it gives you a little bit of different psychological tools as well as what I mentioned before with the glycosides being released. So that's a really important part. And then don't forget about the aftertaste, because just because the beer's gone, the taste isn't gone yet. And really pay attention to those mouthfeel elements. We haven't talked about those, but they're very, very important in beer. Those are things like tannins and astringency, of creaminess, silky character, oiliness. There's a few of them, but they're very, very important in beer, because beer has a texture. It has a sort of a protein network that gives it its body. It's called a colloid, and it's the same structure as Jell-O, just a lot thinner, and really has a certain texture to it. So you want to pay very much attention to that. It's super important. And then, also think about mostly, again, if you're judging, you're going to be doing all of this through the lens of the style. So make sure you got your style guidelines handy. They usually, if at competitions, they've got copies on the table, or now people have them on their phones. And you want to really be able to refer to those, and quite often you'll get on any given flight, you'll get what I call the heartbreak beer, and it's usually often the best beer on the table, but it's not quite in style. And so out it goes. And, you know, for certain types of brewers, you know, I'm sort of in this category who kind of use styles as just sort of guidelines and maybe suggestions. And so I've never really entered a lot of competition because my beers tend to be a little too strong or weak or in between categories or just not quite on the nose. So, in the judging, that's a very important thing to make sure that those beers are do what the style guidelines say that they should do. So that's super important. And then, you know, follow that. The judging forums always give you basically a script that guide you through the process and help you out with numerical rankings and give you little check boxes often for certain kinds of off flavors and things like that. So you're not just sitting there with no prompting. You have a whole structure to go by. So that's the process, basically.
So do you prefer to capture your sort of overall impression up front, or do you like to do it at the end?
I don't like to write it down until I've really had a chance to deconstruct the beer. So I'll go through the forums. I know there are some judges that are like, you know, they'll taste the beer and they go 42. And then they kind of figure out how they're going to get there. So there was one brewer back in the day that was quite famous for doing that. It used to cause a lot of trouble, but so I don't think you want to do that. But I think usually for the most part, you know, you get a smell and get that beer in your mouth, and you've got a pretty good idea within a few seconds of, is this going to be a really great beer, or is this going to be a really problem beer, or where maybe something in the middle. So it's amazing how quickly you can make those decisions. Homebrewing, you typically have 10, 15 minutes of beer. Commercial competitions like the GABF, it may be a little bit less than that because the forums are a little simpler and you've got more highly trained judges that don't need quite as much time. But you really doesn't take a lot of beer to taste, and it doesn't take a lot of time to really get to the meat of the matter and decide whether a beer is good, bad, great, indifferent, whatever it is.
Now, what do you do when your friend hands you a real stinker? You know, I've had guys come up to me, oh yeah, I homebrew, and they bring over some, you know, Canadian lager that's been done at room temperature that's really pretty bad. What do you do then?
Well, you know, I start asking questions usually, and I think people really kind of want the real answer. And if they don't, you can tell pretty easily. I tend to be a little bit, you know, I don't want to be mean. And, but if people say, I really, really know, really tell me, it's like, well, let's talk about the malt. Like, what kind of water did you use? How did you ferment this? What kind of yeast? And so I start picking away, and usually they have an idea, you know. And when you're a famous beer guy, and you know, you're this way too, people bring you beer and stick it in your face and say, this is a beer I brewed. I really hate it. What's wrong with it? And, so, you know, so it's like, oh, has this beer got chocolate malt in it? Oh yeah, I love chocolate malt. It's like, no, you love the name. And, but the malt's too roasty for what you're trying to do here. So,
So you take the politician's approach, you answer the question with another question, right?
Yeah, I think that's perfectly appropriate. Perfect, yeah. If they want really neutral feedback, enter a competition and you'll get the written forms and everything. And I think that's, and I always tell them that it's like, you really want good, honest feedback. You'll get three judges who have no idea who you are and have plenty of time to think about it. So it's a better way to get feedback than just shoving a beer in somebody's face. Awesome. So.
Well, a lot of homebrewers don't think too much about the presentation of their beer, but as you mentioned, the temperature, the packaging, the pour, even the choice of glass that you serve the beer in can make a huge difference.
It absolutely can. You know, a lot of this is psychological. You know, Belgians, for example, have glassware that every brewery has its own glass, and it's got the logo on there, and every glass is different. And the Belgians will all tell you that every one of them is scientifically designed to maximize the aroma and emphasize the nature of the beer. But the truth of the matter,
I do enjoy a lot of the Belgian beer glass. You know, they're almost like little wine glasses.
I love the glasses.
That's one of my favorite beers, you know, favorite to serve beer in usually.
Yeah. I mean, I think a tulip is a perfect beer glass.
Exactly. Like a, yeah, that's what I was talking about.
So something that's it's got a bowl and then it narrows in and then it flares, the lip flares out just a little bit. I think that's a perfect beer glass. And, but on the other hand, there's a lot of other glasses that they use there that some marketing guy in 1965 just picked it out of a catalog and said, yeah, let's go with that. So, you know, there's a lot of nonsense in the glass world and you could take it too seriously, but having that headspace, again, pouring a beer, not completely full, having that curve that goes in a little bit is really important. Some of the newer glasses like the Sam Adams glass, they actually etched a little circle on the bottom that creates nucleation sites. And that allows bubbles to release over time. And it's funny when you have that glass with beer in it, after about 15 minutes, as the head settles down, you actually get a little foam donut on the surface of the beer that is telegraphing up from the bottom, from that circular shape at the bottom. And what that means for your beer is you're replenishing the head all the time. And you're also, like, every time a bubble pops, it's full of beer aroma, right? So having a continuous evolution of bubbles means you've got gas and aroma coming off of that beer for the whole part of the tasting. And that's an old trick they used to do in champagne glasses, just take a diamond and scratch an X at the bottom of a champagne flute just for that same purpose. More of a visual thing, I think, with champagne, just to keep those bubbles flowing. But, you know, and then there's certain just style appropriate things. I love the look of a Pilsner glass on a beautiful tall Pilsner vase.
Yeah,
you know,
a wheat in a tall glass is just amazing. It takes 5 minutes to pour it, but it's fantastic.
And those are great in bars too, because there's a little bit of theater around those, around the Hefeweiss, and you get this big tall glass. It's like a foot tall, and everybody in the bar could see this glass, and you see people kind of craning their necks, saying, "Oh, what are they drinking over there? That looks kind of interesting." And they put a lemon slice on it, and sometimes or not. My friends hate the lemon, but I'm kind of like, you know, if you like, I think the lemon's a little bit of showbiz, and if you don't like it, ask for it not to be put on or take it off and or whatever. But I think that anything we can do just to enhance presentation and make sure people know we're proud of our beer and that we care about it and we respect it. And it's not an illusion that beer will taste better. You know, we're just constructed that way. We cannot ignore all those outside things. So if you put beer in a really, like, just take one beer and put it in a beer glass and take the same beer and put it in a wine glass, put it in front of people, that wine glass, they're going to get all kind of stuff out of that they're not going to get in the beer glass. So,
and like I said, the same thing with a wheat glass, big tall head on a wheat is fantastic, you know? Mm-hmm. Well, you have a great chapter on beer and food, and you said you updated that quite a bit. I was wondering, much like wine, what you're eating is going to drastically change your perception of the beer. Can you talk about that for a minute?
Yeah, it's actually a very complicated area. And as I said, we've been working with this committee that we put together through Julia Hers at the BA, and trying to demystify the process a little bit, strip it down to its essential components and make it clear for people. We actually are presenting at Craft Beer Conference. We're presenting a beer pairing evaluation sheet. So it's a sheet that's designed to sit at the table as you're trying pairing, and it breaks the process down into there's an overall, but then before that there are three areas. And the first one is trying to make sure that the beer and the food are similar enough in overall intensity so that one is not stomping all over the other one. And then the second, which is the, like, the very place you start with the pairing, because really all bets, like, nothing's going to happen with the pairing if you can't taste one of the partners, right? So mm-hmm. That's just common sense. So you can wash a hamburger down with a American light lager, but you're going to lose the beer totally. So if the idea is to have both partners kind of playing an active role. They don't have to be exactly the same intensity, but you do want to make sure that one is not overwhelming the other. So then you're looking at the dynamics of taste and mouthfeel. And these are things like sweetness, bitterness, texture, astringency, fat, and food has certain ones of them. Beer has other ones. There's a good deal of overlap, but there are, like, food generally doesn't have bitterness, but beer quite often does. And these things counteract each other in very specific ways. So, and then on top of that, carbonation is helpful because it will scrub off the palate, and alcohol can be helpful because it's actually a pretty good solvent. So in higher alcohol beers, maybe a Belgian triple, you might be actually getting a little bit of action of that, of the alcohol that's starting to help dissolve some of the fats and things like that in the beer. So bitterness will cut fat. Bitterness will cut sweetness. That's one of those, like, you take a bitter, like an IPA, and put it together with a cheesecake or some kind of really sweet dessert. It's amazing how much less bitter that sweet food will make the beer, and it's amazing how much less sweet the beer will make the food. So they really transform each other. You see this with cheese a lot, with bitterness and fat. The famous,
but of course, fat also destroys the head in the beer, right? The lipids, you know, do.
Yeah, the lipids do, but you're not actually putting the cheese in your glass of beer, unless, I don't know, maybe that's a new kind of tasting. It's like a beer fondue or something.
It comes off your lips, though, you know.
It comes off your lips.
Like, well, if you're eating a hamburger, for example.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, I mean, the fat will do it. Fat will kill a head. That's one more sign of a dirty glass. That's the price you pay for having a pairing. So not much we can really do about that. Mm-hmm. And then the third thing is you're trying to find aromatic harmonies, right? So most of the connecting points that you're going to find in a beer between the beer and the food come from aroma. All right. So you're not really looking at the tastes of salty, bitter, umami, whatever, to find similarities. Those things are all quite different from each other. But with aroma, you have an enormous overlap. You know, we've talked about the vocabulary of malt. So you take a malty beer that has a certain caramelly quality, and you can put that with a food that has either, you know, it could be caramelized onions or it could be actual caramel. And now you've created a link between foods that have similar chemicals in them because the processes that were used to create them are similar. Also, hops have several hundred aroma chemicals. And these are chemicals that are found in many different kinds of spices and herbs. They're found in flowers. They're found in various kinds of citrus and other types of fruits. So you have all these different places to find similar molecules, or the same molecules, really, that occur in beer and also occur in different kinds of foods. And then there are other types of harmonious flavors that aren't the same at all, right? So if you think about buttery, like creamy, buttery sorts of flavors, and toast, like a toasty kind of flavor, mm-hmm. those are not in any way similar, but we love them. You know, if you think about a grilled cheese sandwich, you know, those are those two things combined. And quite often you can use a beer to supply that toasty component and sort of replace it. And you'll get a pairing that has a lot of harmony, even though the flavors aren't, the aromas are not the same. And so one of the things I did in the book is tried to create a way to graph those out a little bit and show the relationships between things like fruitiness and caramel and dairy and herbal and floral and spicy and meaty, and really try and map those out a little bit to help people understand how those flavors relate, even though they're not the same. And these are cultural things, right? So, like, if you think about chocolate and vanilla, they're a match made in heaven, but they're completely different chemicals. They're completely different aromatic sensations. But since we were babies, ever since we had our first piece of chocolate cake, we've been accustomed to knowing chocolate together with vanilla. And that's certainly true in the United States and most of Europe and the rest of the Western world. But when you take that idea and try and transpose it to Japan or Korea or someplace like that, they don't have that same cultural experience necessarily. It's not certainly not part of their traditional cuisines. So these kinds of things, these familiarity pairings can be really based on where we've been and what we've been doing and what our personal histories are and our cultural histories. So it's pretty fascinating to think about those as well. But that's one not to miss on, because sometimes you'll get a really great pairing. I do a fresh creamy mozzarella cheese with a Bavarian Hefeweizen, and in the end what you get is something that sort of tastes like peaches and cream, because you've got this milk explosion in the cheese that's just like milky, creamy, really just fresh dairy. And then you take the Hefeweizen and it's got a little bit of spice, but it's got a ton of fruit. And when you put it with mozzarella, you get almost like a peach ice cream kind of thing. It's really a peaches and cream sort of a sensation. It's pretty amazing.
Sounds awesome.
Yeah, cream, peaches, they have nothing to do with each other, but we love them together because that's ice cream flavor.
Yeah. You spent a lot of time talking about styles, but unfortunately we don't have time to cover all of them. But I did want to talk about the craft beer revolution, which really has exposed a lot of modern beer lovers to these styles. And arguably the U.S. has been leading that. What are some of the trends we're seeing in the craft beer industry that are really driving whole beer industry now?
Well, of course the big one is IPA, and, 10 years ago, we had IPA, and I put a recipe in my Radical Brewing book back in 2003, I think it was, for a red IPA, and nobody had ever heard of that. It was radical at the time, and now, of course, we have red IPAs, black IPAs, session IPAs, Belgian IPAs, triple IPAs, fruited IPAs. What am I missing?
Double IPAs.
White IPAs.
Northeastern IPAs.
And now we have the Northeastern or New England style IPA, which is pretty fascinating. And that's really new. That's really only been the last couple of years or so that people are starting to pay attention to those. And pretty interesting style. I think that we've been fooling around with them at Forbidden Root, our brewer there, it's fair to say, he's obsessed with them right now, but he really sort of tore into it and kind of tried to figure out what makes them tick. And I think there's some there.
You finished with a chapter titled A Sip Beyond. Tell us about some of the interesting topics there.
Well, the book, the book covers this whole tasting process and beer and styles, but I thought it was important to talk about some of the other things that also are tangential, but are also really important. So I talk about beer judging. I talk about beer clubs. I talk about home brewing, certainly for your readership, it's changed their lives. And for many people who get into beer, home brewing is the thing that really catapults them into a different dimension in beer and leads them to do crazy things like start small breweries and things like that. So I talk about researching old beers. I think the biggest part of the chapter is on beer cocktails. So I expanded that a little bit. I've been teaching a Doman's beer sommelier class at Siebel and was asked to develop a chapter on or a unit on beer cocktails. So I expanded that and put that in the book as well, because I thought that was kind of fun. Everything ranging from that hot, creamy concoction called Flip that you basically cook some eggs in beer, not quite till they're curdled, and then you jab a red hot poker into it. It fizzes and fumes and it's quite fun to do at a Christmas party. So and then of course to more modern, to shandies and rattlers and things like that, and then more modern full-on creative cocktails. So there's a lot there, kind of fun to play around with, to extend beer, make it work in situations and with people that beer wouldn't normally be the go-to.
Well, Randy, unfortunately, we're already at the end of our time. We had a few more topics to cover. It's a great book. I encourage people to look up Tasting Beer, which I've got right here, Tasting Beer.
Yeah, and, thanks.
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Yeah, thank you very much. It's always great to talk about beer with you.
Yeah, it's great having you on the show, Randy. Thank you again for being here.
My pleasure.
And again, today my guest was Mr. Randy Mosher, author of the newly revised second edition of Tasting Beer. as well as two of my other favorite books on brewing, Mastering Homebrew and Radical Brewing, both of which I can recommend. You can find Randy at randymosher.com. Thanks again, Randy.
Awesome, Brad. Thank you much.
Well, a big thank you to Randy Mosher for joining me this week. Thanks also to Craft Beer and Brewing Magazine. Every issue is packed with great information for homebrewers and craft beer fans. Take advantage of their fantastic sale and get a year-long subscription for only $19.99 from beerandbrewing.com. And also Blickman Engineering, creators of the innovative new BrewVision wireless thermometer. Remotely monitor your brewing system from your iPhone or iPad, record data, set alerts, and grab recipes directly from the Beersmith Cloud. The BrewVision thermometer, another innovation from BlickmanEngineering.com. And finally, Beersmith Mobile. The mobile version of Beersmith is a perfect complement to our desktop brewing software. Check out Beersmith Mobile at beersmith.com/mobile or on Google Play, iTunes, or the Amazon App Store. Thank you for listening, and I hope you have a great brewing week.